This episode is brought to you by Lululemon. 10 years ago, Lululemon created a yoga legging. A legging made of a revolutionary fabric that was as soft as it was stretchy. A legging that followed every curve, felt virtually weightless, and held in place during even the toughest poses. They called it Align, and we've been stretching ourselves in it ever since. Now discover the full Align collection, 10 years in the making, at lululemon.co.uk.
Hello, folks. This is Risk, the show where people tell true stories they never thought they'd dare to share. I'm Kevin Allison, and this is our 777th episode. And it's also one of our new video format episodes. If you're hearing this on the podcast feed, just know that there's a link to the video version in the show notes. And if you're watching this, don't miss our audio podcast, where we've been sharing boldly told, jaw-dropping true stories for over 15 years. There are thousands of stories for you on Risk, wherever you get your podcasts, or at risk-show.com. Today, we're featuring a story by Susan Liu that she told in 2018 at a Risk Live show, and a conversation I had with her in 2025 about it. Susan's story is called 140 pounds, that's the weight that her mother was when she passed away. So, without further ado, here is Susan Liu. Okay, I'm here with Susan again. Oh my gosh, Susan, this is so funny. Neither of us has heard this story since, I think, 2018, right?
That's right.
Or at least this recording. You've done many, many, many versions of stories that include what happens in this story. But this original 2018 version, it'll be very, very fresh for us. All right, let's give it a listen and see what we think.
I lost my mom when I was 11. I don't have many memories about my mom, but I know that my entire family calls her the hero. She grew up in the Mekong Delta in Vietnam, in this small province called Sóc Trăng. It's known for its fermented fish noodle soup. We call it bún nước lèo. To me, when I smell it with the shrimp and the pork and the banana flour and the citrus, I think it smells like home. But maybe most of you, when you smell it, you might think it smells like compost rot. When the bin gets too full, it's super funky, but that's what we're known for. And when my mom was 16 and she was growing up, she had to drop out of high school. She was the best student in her class. She was in ninth grade, and she had to support her 11 brothers and sisters. So she went out into the village. She'd walk down this dirt road every day, and she'd sell lotto tickets. She started selling lotto tickets to people, and she started making money. And then she found out that if she started having other people sell lotto tickets for her, she'd make more money. And then she started having dreams, and she had animals. A pig was one, a cow was two, a water buffalo was three. And then she started figuring out what the numbers were and started buying lotto tickets, and then she started winning. And she won several times. And that's how she saved up enough money to save up for 6 1-ounce gold bars. And that was enough money to pay for 4 tickets out of Vietnam. 4 tickets to try to get on a boat and get to a Malaysian refugee camp. This was after the fall of Vietnam, and everyone was frightened for their lives every day. They didn't know what was gonna happen the next day to them. So she had enough money. She, my dad, my 2 brothers, they were planning an escape. But it wasn't an easy escape. It was risky. Because if any of the communists spotted them or anybody else trying to leave the docks that night, you get thrown into a labor camp, you get thrown into prison, or maybe you just disappear. So that was obstacle number one. That night, she knew it was the night to go, so each parent took a son in their hands and then walked quickly to the docks, and when they got there, the communist lighthouse, it lit up. And all of a sudden, all the passengers had to run back and just run back into the jungle and run as fast as they could. And she started running and she was holding my four-year-old brother hard against her belly. And her shoes started flying off, but she kept running into the darkness. She didn't know where she was going. And she ran into a thorny patch. And every step she took, more and more thorns went into her body. And then her foot became a bloody mess. And then she came back to my grandma's house. And you could see all these bloody footprints coming through the house. And she'd lie down in the hammock. And my grandma would cry saying, "This is the last time you're going to do this. It's not worth it. And you're going to die out there. So stop doing this." And my grandma would take this needle and just take all the thorns out of her foot. Take all the thorns out of her foot and wipe all the blood off her feet. And say, "Stop doing this." And my mom did it again and again and again. And on the sixth time, they finally just made it onto a boat. And the boat made it past the communists. And after 3 days at sea, they made it to a Malaysian refugee camp. My sister was born in that camp. And after 2 years, we made it to America. And I was born in 85. When we were in America, it was all about the family business. Susan's Nails, named after me. My sister's so pissed about it to this day. In the family, everyone had a part to play. And I remember I was 4 years old, and when all the customers, you know, were backed up and people aren't starting at the right appointment time, she'd look over at me and she'd nod. And I knew I gotta turn on the charm. And so I'd go up to the customers that were waiting and be like, "Oh, hi, Betty. How's your dog? Yeah, your hair looks nice." Yeah, and I'd be like taking off her nail polish, really engaged, scheduling the next appointment. It was a family business. And we all had to take part in it. And I felt like I got to take part in my mom's dream. I know some of you might be thinking, isn't that called child labor? I call it, all Vietnamese refugees, we call it free daycare. It's a very good model. You should think about it. My mom, she was tough as nails, and she only prioritized education. She couldn't finish ninth grade, so when we got to America, she wanted us to focus on school. So I wanted to play trombone. I wanted to play with Todd in band class, but I was not allowed to. And I remember one morning, I woke up really early, and I was going to gather the courage to tell her, "I'm going to try out for volleyball tryouts." Yeah, and I'm getting ready to ask her, and I see my mom and dad in the kitchen shuffling about, and they're moving about, and it's weird because this is way too early for them to go to the nail salon. And I say, "Ma, where are you guys going?" And she said, oh, "We're going to be back later, it's fine." "But Ma, it's 6 a.m. and you guys go to the shop at 8 a.m., so where are you guys going?" "We're coming home late tonight, it's fine." "Well, I'm coming home late tonight, too. I'm not coming home at 3. I'm coming home at 5. I'm going to volleyball tryouts." And she said, "Oh, no, you're not. You have school." And I was like, "I'm in the under-minute club with the multiplication tables. I'm smart. I have school handled. I want to do tryouts." And she said, "Nun," which means shut up. And I said, "You can't tell me what to do. I'm going to volleyball tryouts, and I'm going to make the team, and I'm going to show you, and I'm going to do whatever I want, and I hate you." The car's running. They get in the car. They close the door. I slam the garage door. I hear the car roll out. I hear the door close. That's the last time I ever talked to my mom. And I come back home from school, from tryouts, and my brother says, "Susan, Mom's in a coma." And when I get to the hospital, I see my dad in the doorway of the room, and I walk over there, and I look at the bed, and that's not my mom. That's a body. That's a vegetable. And when I see her lying there, my legs turn into cement legs, and I can't move, and I can't say anything. And then my dad says, "Go, And he pushes me behind my back and he says, go talk to her. And I said, say what to her? Just go talk to her. And it feels like ages, me just trying to drag my legs over and then walk and sit down. And he goes, hold her hand. So then I pick up her hand. And her body is this weird yellow color, because all the liquid of her natural body has soaked down into this little tub next to her of all this liquid. And I'm holding her hand and it's cold. It is so cold. And the only color on her body is her red nails, because she thought she'd come out of a that day with her beautiful nails. Talk to her. So finally, when I'm ready to talk to her, I said, Ma, you always said that when I go to college, you'd move in with me. So can you come back so you can go to college with me? Can you come back to me? Ma? After 5 days in a coma, she flatlined. It's always hard when people ask me what my mom died of. It's not something that you can immediately feel sorry for, like cancer or getting hit on the sidewalk by a car. She died from plastic surgery. She went in for a tummy tuck, the narrowing of her nostrils, and a chin implant with Dr. Frank Thomas, a plastic surgeon in San Francisco who had 24 lawsuits against him, had been on probation for years, been sanctioned by the medical board 2 times, operated in an unaccredited facility. She walked into this clinic and she didn't know what she was walking into. 2 hours in the operation, her narrowing of her nostrils goes fine. They're working on the tummy tuck. And then the siren goes off. She's lost oxygen to her brain. The nurse tells the doctor tries to do mouth to mouth immediately, lifts her legs up, tries to figure things out, gives her extra medication, and nothing is happening. Usually, after not having oxygen for 4 minutes, you have permanent brain damage. And it was at the 14-minute mark that he calls 911. And turns out the clinic was a block and a half away from the hospital. So I'm in my late 20s now, and I'm at business school. I'm staying up late at night working on a statistics problem set, but I don't want to do it because I keep thinking about Dr. Frank. And I keep thinking, how does a man like him, he kills somebody, he continues to have a track record, how do you just lose your license for a couple years and keep on practicing? Where's the justice in this system? I can't stop thinking about him. And I said, you know, I'm going to Google this motherfucker. And turns out he was still practicing. And he was still on probation. So I decided, because I was getting an MBA, I was going to seek revenge, but with a multi-prong marketing campaign. And I was going to get him, because I found out a couple of things. I found out that he targeted Vietnamese women in the weekly Vietnamese newspaper. 30% of his clients were Vietnamese. And he also had volunteered his time during the Vietnam War doing reconstructive surgery. I couldn't put my finger on it. There was something really odd about this guy. But maybe instead of just the negligence on my mom, maybe there was a class action lawsuit. So I was going to go at it that way. But then also, I was going to have a marketing campaign where he starts to feel paranoid. I was going to have targeted Facebook ads so that he'd click on Facebook and he'd see his face and it would say, I am watching you. And he'd look at him and be like, ah, that's me, but I'm watching myself. Who is watching me if I'm watching myself, right? And then, so that would start the paranoia. And then he would drive into work and then there would be a billboard and it would be all the women that he's hurt. And it'd say, we've got your eyes on you. And then he'd be like, what? This is so confusing. And then I would stage protests in front of the clinic so that any new patient would know who they were going under with the knife. And my final trick in all of this is I was going to schedule an appointment to get breast implants. And I would sit in front of him, and he would be like, so, how'd you hear about us? And I'd say, oh, I've done my research. And then he'd say, well, what are you here to get done? And then I'd slowly unzip my bag and say, revenge. And then I'd pull out the subpoenas and I'd put it there and I'd slide it onto the desk. And then I'd get up and walk away, very slowly, just looking at him for a long time until I closed the door. That's what I was gonna do. I was up late one night, and so I was talking to my friend Amanda. She went to Harvard Law School, and I was like, Amanda, I need you to do research on this, figure out how we're gonna structure the case. Tell me how this is all gonna go down. I was so excited about my plan, and then she said to me, Susan, he's dead. And all of a sudden, my mouth, it turned sour. It was all the sour enzymes that you get when you start to throw up, and it got sour all over through my mouth and through my stomach. And then I just felt like my body just slipped out onto the floor, onto the mess of all the research of my papers, and that hero that I wanted to be for my family was gone. All of that was for nothing. And I said to her, Amanda, can you sue dead people? And turns out you can't. This has been a really hard journey for me because I'm a Buddhist and I should be compassionate and have loving kindness for all beings. And I should forgive people and see the good in them. And that's been hard to do. But I think I could do that if I could humanize them or get to know them. So I sent a letter to one of his kids. His son is a marriage and family therapist. And my siblings thought I was totally crazy. And they're like, what are you doing? And I said, I got to do what I need to do. And then 3 days later, I got a call. It's the youngest daughter, Megan. And she said, Susan, I got your letter, and I want you to know that I'm really, 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 really sorry. And I can't imagine this happening to my family. And I want you to know that your mom's death impacted me the most. Call me back. So I texted her. And then 3 days passed. And so then I called and left a voicemail. A few more days passed. And I texted her a couple more times. And that's where things stand now. My siblings think that she might have gotten spooked. Maybe she thinks I'm going to sue her or her family. So like a nerd, I looked up if I could sue her, and I can't. And so I wrote her a letter of all the statutes of limitations of why I can't do anything. I had a 4-year window since 1999 to do something, and so now I can't. In the letter, I also said this. I'd just like to know more. The kind of person your father was, how you felt about his work, how he felt about his work. Maybe I'm trying to make sense of what happened, or at the very least, trying to come to peace with it. By us connecting, I hope we can rewrite the narrative we pass down to future generations. That while we cannot undo the past, the human spirit is capable of forgiveness. So I'm just waiting, and I'm hoping. Maybe she's going to hear this recording and pick up the phone and call me.
Wow. Holy cow. You know, it's so funny because I just remember how emotional the story was, but to hear it again, just how many twists and turns and just like how many jaw-dropping moments there are is really, really something. And it's so beautiful and almost unbelievable. I mean, you know, it's hard to believe. I mean, of course, I understand totally the effort to have compassion there at the end. But yeah, oof, it's so much.
It's such a trip to hear this again.
I'm sure. All right, we're going to take a little break, and then we will really dig into what this was like for both of us.
We'll be right back. This season of Revisionist History, we're investigating everything from the secret behind the perfect nooks and crannies in Thomas's English muffins to the merits of Paw Patrol against its critics.
There's some things that really piss me off when it comes to Paw Patrol.
It's pretty simple. It sucks.
My son watches Paw Patrol. I hate it.
Everyone hates it, except for me. Listen to Revisionist History wherever you get your podcasts.
We're back. Okay, and I am back with Susan Liu today. Today as in 2025, having just listened to the story again. Oh my gosh. So yeah, what was that like for you?
I mean, I felt so many things. So, man, I from a technical perspective, I'm sitting there going like, Susan, you use the word and clocking in maybe 45 times.
Oh, I hate that. You know? I hate that. Yeah.
I mean, part of me was just like, Susan, you were so adorable. You were so earnest. Like, trying to figure out what happened, right? And remember, this is me 7 years ago. Since then, I've learned so much more about my mom. And the doctor and his family. And it's so interesting how everything has evolved since then.
Huh.
But also just like the key points, the key emotional moments in the story continue to live on in my one-woman show, in my book. Mm-hmm. But the way I've later shaped it and what I've done with it is drastically different in the other formats that I've taken this story on. So it's
fascinating.
It's cool to see Ernest Susan just first starting out and trying to make my way and get confidence on the stage again.
Yeah.
Because it was about 5 years prior to this, I used to do stand-up comedy, and I loved it. And then I got heckled one day at a charity comedy show. And I walk away so ashamed of like, oh my God, who did I think I was to be on stage?
Oh no, oh God.
And so to come back to a risk stage, this was kind of like a comeback for me, Kevin. I don't think you knew the context at the time, but I was so terrified of the stage, but it drew me. It was this, it's a magnet for me to be on stage, so I can hear how much I enjoy being on stage, but at the same time, I am still really grasping for the technical beats of how to be an effective storyteller. So that's what I'm just sitting here kind of criticizing myself, but also thinking, oh, Susan, you're so cute.
Well, you know, I always tell people in workshops that your brain has to kind of be three places at once. First, like you said, story structure. And then is just like, what is the audience understanding this? But third, emotionally present. And you were super emotionally present. And that is like the most important part.
Yeah. I mean, I mean, I'm sitting here still going like, wow. I would have rewritten, it all over again, right? But I think that's the unraveling of stories, is that we're constantly rewriting them as we get to know ourselves.
Totally.
So it's just interesting. Like, this is an artifact in time. My one-woman show, 140 pounds, is, and so is my book. And each time I'm taking things like the imagery of my mom's bloody feet, and later I turn it into a chapter, but it's really stitched together nicely because finally my family starts to open up and talk. And what we see in this piece here of this version of 140 pounds is my fixation on the doctor as the person who will give me my salvation. He's the one that's going to give me closure around my family. But what it has evolved to since then is actually this is not a story about the doctor at all, but really the story of my mother and my family's unwillingness to talk about the past and my search to have closure with them. And I think as I've evolved over the years to hone in on that, right? Because remember, we're not allowed to talk about in our family about her, that it becomes a more beautiful story, right? It's really about this evil revenge, which was very true and honest for me, right? But it was, I could only find closure about my mom's death when I could see how I love her and how do I grapple with loving my family when it's hard, right? Mm-hmm. And I think that was the heart of the story of as it's evolved to today, which is it's really not about the doctor at all.
Yeah, that's incredible. You know, it's so funny. The first thing that really struck me about listening this time was that I remembered the first part of the story, but had not remembered, I had remembered that as maybe being someone else's story or someone else's mom. I thought the story started in the United States, and I was like, oh my gosh, wait, the bloody feet situation is this same story. So that was kind of weird, the way our memory can do that. And as I was listening this time, I was like, oh, I can see where Susan gets so much goddamn gumption and balls got so much like drive. And here, listening to, all the way back to Vietnam as after the war, I was like, oh, wow, able to put two and two together then that, you are so much your mother's daughter.
Yeah. Okay, let me be honest about this one. I totally forgot my plan to schedule an appointment and get plastic surgery from him and deliver a subpoena. Like, I'm sitting here, I was listening to that going like, The fuck? That was, I did that? What? Did I really plan that? And I'm sitting there going like, well, that's just how fickle memory is, right?
Because
I was like, did I really plan that? Like, I don't even remember thinking about that. And then now that when I hear the recording, I'm like, yeah, that still checks out. Like, I probably would have done that. But that was a trip because I was like, oh, I don't even remember that. Like, I didn't even fold that into my future work. And I was like, huh, oh, that's interesting.
Totally, totally. Yeah, there are times when I'm telling a story and I come to the next beat of something and it just flows out of me. And then I start to think, wait, did that really happen? It's like because the brain needs to like be connecting things narratively.
Yeah, so crazy. Okay, so then I'm listening to the story and then I'm talking about how the doctor didn't have medical malpractice insurance. And what happened is he actually walked away, never paid my family anything. 2 years after he lost his license, he went back to practice and he was on probation for the rest of his life. What 2018 Susan doesn't realize is that because the medical system is so unfair and not really towards protecting patients, but really towards protecting doctors, what I would go on to do is address the medical malpractice caps. So like in California, your life is worth $250,000 if you die from medical malpractice.
Mm.
That amount has not changed since 1975. Mm. It never adjusted to inflation.
Right.
And so when I start investigating about the doctor and writing my story, I'm like, how does that still exist?
Mm-hmm.
And I think because I was not able to avenge my mother's death with the doctor, I eventually said, well, how can we do that with patient advocacy? How can we do that with changing a law? And so in 2023, I worked with Consumer Watchdog based in Santa Monica so that we would change it, the law, so it would adjust to inflation to $1.3 million. So what I didn't realize, I started as a storyteller and then I started to evolve into an activist, right? Like I was just like, if I can't help my mom, if I can't reclaim any money for my dad, what can I do for other people, right?
Wow. And
so it's just kind of funny, like looking back on it now, I didn't realize me returning to the stage would also be this beautiful union of all parts of me. Creative Susan, business entrepreneur Susan, and also social justice Susan.
Amazing.
And so it's kind of like I'm sitting here listening to this young woman who I'm like, oh, she's so adorable. Listening to her and then like, I don't even know what's ahead of me. I don't even know that I'm going to go on to do another part of my life's work as related to my mom and that I eventually will go on a 10-city national tour when I'm pregnant and also eventually get a book deal. Like, right? Like me returning to the stage that night in Seattle at the Vera Project, it was a coming home to me, right? Of like trying to feed that part of me that is so important, but I was just so lost. And so it's just so beautiful that like it still sounds like a cluster of a story to me. Like I'm sitting there going like, oh God, Susan, oh, like it's too scrambled. Like I'm sitting there going like it is so all over the place. Even though that was like probably like 8 drafts. I probably wrote 8 drafts to get to there. but the adrenaline of being on stage in front of other people. It's like, okay, Susan, you know your keywords, you know your key beats. Like, now just tell the story.
Right.
But still, like, the perfectionist to me was like, hit all the lines. And then to the point where it's just like, I'm sitting here, and maybe what I'm trying to tell you, Kevin, is instead of me just being my inner critic out loud, it's more like, hey, I feel like I've really evolved as a storyteller. And
that's beautiful.
I'm proud of the progress, you know?
Absolutely. And instead of thinking critically, I mean, because it was super, super duper powerful for me to hear it again. And as far as like the narrative arc and everything went, it also like completely worked for me in that way too. So it's great to know, because I do that all the time too. Like, I have to sometimes listen to old episodes of Risk. And and like you said, like, that's one of the things, like a repeated word. Like, and I noticed I did it recently. I told a story on stage and then had to listen to it back. And I said, right, a bunch of times, like, right, you know? And I'm like, where the fuck did this one come from? So yeah, like, oh my gosh. But that's beautiful to see, to be able to see it as a work in progress. And yeah, the way that stories are always evolving along with us. Yeah.
And I learned so much. I've learned so much about my mom and me since then. So it's really interesting how I go on stage and I try to tell everyone everything I know, and that's it. That's everything I know. And it's through more years of more research, and then my family realizing I'm not going to stop, that they start to share more information with me.
Oh, wow.
And you can really see the family story emerge instead of it being about the doctor.
Yeah, for sure. And now the book is in paperback.
Yeah, The Manicurist's Daughter. It's my memoir, and it's so interesting. Like, it's an artifact for my son. And of his cousins, right? My siblings, yeah. Right? Because there's so much that everyone has learned when they do attend my shows or read the book. Because no one – I think there's so much shame and silence in families that no one is going to make the effort to piece it all together and make sure they get it historically accurate and chronologically, you know, right there. And
that's huge.
It was exhausting. Writing the memoir, it took 2 years. It was exhausting. But now it's so beautiful to have this artifact, just like the Risk recording. You know, it's just – it's a snapshot in time of what I do know. And it's important to have those snapshots in time because memory's fickle.
Totally. And there's an audiobook version too, right?
Yes. I got to record it.
I love it.
It was so much fun.
Yeah. Well, that's the thing. Like, you have such a great voice and you're so emotionally present.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's amazing. Mm. Oh my gosh. But that's so great to know that, you know, that was kind of, well, it wasn't the first step because there were steps that came before, but that was an important step along the journey.
Oh, my God. It was one of the first times I came back onto a stage and to feel that adrenaline with the microphone in your hand and everyone looking at you. And you're realizing, like, it's up to me to go forward now. Like, I have to start. I'm going to stop and start the entire experience. It ends with me, here we go. And not even to know how it's going to end. Right? Like, I never know when I'm going to cry. Like, I never know. I noticed a couple lines that I messed up on where I didn't know what I was supposed to say. So I just kind of fubbed it. Oh my God. I'm so critical. But there is just something so powerful and cathartic about public storytelling to bare your soul. And it's this symbiotic relationship where you're receiving the audience's energy.
Oh yeah.
Right? Oh,
yeah.
And it really intensifies the moment and cements it for me as like a core memory in my life.
Yeah. And me, like, just at the Vera Project, because that was at the Vera Project in Seattle. Oh my gosh, just to think of some of the moments of Risk going back there and some of the extraordinary, I remember after one of the shows we did there, the whole audience just stood up to like hug each other after the lights came back up.
Oh my God, that's beautiful.
Yeah, but it just goes to show that, you know, Seattle's quite a town.
Yeah, I remember one of the other storytellers that night was Ellen Aquario, and she's she's a stand-up comic. I was just on her podcast. It's called YC, Reply Yochin to Your Girlfriend. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And it was so great to be there talking about motherhood, talking about the book, but also be like, wow, we shared that stage years ago, you know.
That's so cool.
Each of us has taken our own creative journeys since then. Mm-hmm. It was just such a special moment. Thank you so much for that.
She's one of those folks who have, like, you know, risk babies. Like, you end up befriending them on Facebook, and then you feel like, oh my gosh, I'm watching their children grow up now.
Yeah.
So funny. Oh my goodness. Well, thank you so much for like the honor of revisiting this. And everyone, go get The Manicurist's Daughter. It's in paperback, it's an audiobook. Like, it's quite a bigger picture of this whole story.
Yes, thank you so much for having me. And, you know, being on Risk, it just planted this seed for me to really bloom. Right.
That's beautiful.
Kind of nurture the storyteller in me that has always been there, but was so dormant and so afraid, terrified, anxious. And being able to share my story through your team to help produce it, but also like that time and space for the procrastinator self in me to actually get my shit together. It propelled me to here, and I'm sure you provide that opportunity for so many other storytellers, for them to bloom in their craft and for them to deeply discover who they are. So thank you. Thank you for that.
Oh, thank you. That's awesome. It's amazing. All right. Well, folks, that is it for this revisited look at 140 pounds. Which was also the name of your solo show. Now, do you ever do the solo show again, like these days?
Oh my God. In 2019, I performed it 60 times to 7,000 people.
Oh my gosh, that is a lot.
It's 65 minutes and I play 15 characters.
Oh my gosh.
I know. It's like so intense. And so now I have a 5-year-old and I'm just like so tired. And I'm like, who was that person who took it on Intensity National Tour when I was pregnant? I was like, that was superhuman.
Yes, totally.
So I'm kind of like, y'all, please stream
get
it.
Get the book.
You can stream 140 pounds from my website for $4.99. Uh-huh. You can watch the whole thing. It's cut on 3 cameras. So I thought it looked all right. But because I don't have the energy to do that again. I am this summer going to a writer's residency, and I might be writing the third piece in the play, because that's 140 pounds. Then I did a sequel over 140 pounds. And the third one, I won't disclose the title, but I'm working on that and I'm exploring that. I don't have any plans yet to take it on tour. I kid you not, because I just turned 40, I was like, Susan, you're not getting any younger. Let's keep doing things that are terrifying. And
of course.
Not usually the normal response, but that's my response. And I was like, ooh, like I want to do a 60-minute comedy special. You know, like I want to go back to something I loved that still terrifies me.
Yeah.
So I'm definitely thinking about that. And you know, it's got some one-woman show elements to it, sure. And continue writing a second book and then also do a screenplay for a TV show. So
oh my gosh.
I feel like I'm like done with my creative postpartum depression after writing the memoir. And then I feel like I'm ready to take on a few more things. So yeah, if you want to watch 140 pounds, please just stream it from my website and I'll get a small cut of that.
Fabulous.
And it'll feed me to work on my next project.
Great. And we will have a link in the show notes, too. Awesome.
Thanks,
well,
Kevin.
Thank you so much. We'll see you soon.
Bye.
And that is that. I'll tell you, you might have been able to guess that I'm a big fan of audiobooks, and Susan's reading of her beautiful memoir is beautiful in itself, The Manicurist's Daughter. So let us know what you thought of this or any of these stories we've been revisiting and chatting with the storyteller in the present day. We love hearing from you. And you can go to the Risk Podcast Fans Discussion Group on Facebook or leave a comment on the YouTube version of this episode or post on r/Risk Podcast, the subreddit. And if you've got a story about a family secret or the loss of someone very dear to you that you might want to share here, just go to risk-show.com/submissions and send us your pitch because, folks, today's the day. Take a risk.